Zechariah chapter 6, 1 to 8. I looked up again, and there before me were four chariots coming out from between two mountains, mountains of bronze. The first chariot had red horses, the second black, the third white, and the fourth dappled, all of them powerful. I asked the angel who was speaking to me, "What are these, my Lord?" The angel answered me, "These are the four spirits of heaven, going out from standing in the presence of the Lord of the whole world. The one with the black horses is going towards the north country, the one with the white horses towards the west, the one with the dappled horses towards the south." When the powerful horses went out, they were straining to go throughout the earth, and he said, "Go throughout the earth." So they went throughout the earth. Then he called to me, "Look, those going towards the north country have given my spirit rest in the land of the north." So that's the background to the four horses that we have in Revelation chapter 6. But before we actually go into that, a bit of introduction. Everybody knows the difference between a loving and an angry look. A disobedient child looks round to see if anyone's watching, and depending on the look from its parents, can determine how bad the act is in their eyes. An obedient child looks for an approving look. Young lovers look into each other's eyes with a gaze that speaks volumes. And today I'm going to look at the way God looks at the rebellious world that we're in. It's more like a reproachful glare, which is why I've given it the title. We've come to the point in Revelation where some people stop reading it because they find it too complicated. Others, on the other hand, plunge in with delight, because according to them, this is where the good bit starts. Human curiosity can be both good and bad, and unfortunately the way that some people have interpreted the following chapters proves the point. The current trend is to put earthquakes, floods, famine down to climate change, but if we introduce a catastrophic event like 9/11 with the Twin Towers coming down, then people think that's a sign of the end times. So everything gets mixed up in people's minds and they're not quite sure where they're going. I don't believe that Revelation addresses things like the Crusades, the French Revolution, and other things like that, because as we've seen, he was speaking to people in an actual place in Turkey in the first century. So far, we've studied the inaugural vision of the reigning Christ. We've looked at the letters to the seven churches in Asia Minor. We've considered chapters 4 and 5, which tell us that there is a throne in heaven. Millions of people gathered around the throne, worshipping God and the Lamb. Those things just so far are fairly accessible. We've been helped by looking at the background to the churches to whom they were addressed. But as we move forward, let's remind ourselves that we're in the middle of John's second vision, where in the spirit he was transported up to that open door in heaven. He glimpsed things from a heavenly perspective. He saw that throne in heaven, the worship taking place around the throne. And then he saw the person on the throne with a sealed scroll in his hand. He wept because no one was found worthy. And then somebody told him that there was somebody who was worthy. He was told to look at the lion. He turned round and he saw a lamb who is worthy to open the scroll. And now from chapter 6, things do get a bit more complicated. But as I said, I'm not going to suggest that we reach for our calculators or our slide rules to find out what's happening in the earth today and how it corresponds to what was written in the book of Revelation. As we've seen already, John mentions to these people, or he reveals to these people, what must soon take place. We have it in chapter 1, verse 1, verse 19, chapter 4, verse 1, and also in chapter 22, verse 6. We read the messages in the order that we come across them in the scriptures, from verse chapter 1 to chapter 22. But it doesn't mean that they all happen in that order. There's, as we've seen already, that there's to-ing and fro-ing, there's repetition, and we're going to come to that again. The only timetable that we're given is what is must make way for what is to come. So the kingdom of this earth is going to disappear and the kingdom of God will be established on the earth. And John uses these word pictures to give us an idea of the battle that's going on, not going into detail, but a general idea of how things are going to work out. And as we go on, we discover that this is an ongoing struggle, and that Satan is has been vanquished, but like a wounded animal, he attacks and he snarls and he gets all irritable, knowing that his doom is sealed, but towards the end things get worse. I've mentioned the sealed scroll. John sees this one who's sitting on the heavenly throne. The scroll probably contains the program of what is going to happen. He was told that the lion of the tribe of Judah was the only one worthy to open it. Let's face it, God could have just clicked his fingers and sorted everything out just like that. He's powerful enough. He created the world in the blink of an eye. But he didn't. He chose to do it by sending his son to die on the cross for us. And he became the slain lamb. And he's redeeming a people for himself from every tribe, tongue, nation, and so on. And that's the way God chose to do it. And we live in this paradoxical world where the conquering lamb, the conquering lion, is a slain lamb. Not a word is said about the actual contents of this scroll. We don't know whether the scroll handed over is the beginning of the revelation, or if the contents of it lead us right to the end. I believe they do, and I believe that the others, the trumpets and the bowls, do the same thing. But we'll look at that in more detail later on. But I think that Jesus opening the scroll reveals God's purposes during the last day, or the last days. But contrary to what many people believe, we are in the last days already, and we've been in them for a long time. Let's have a look. I'm sure you've heard, as I've heard, that many Christians today, seeing what's going on, say, oh, this is proof that we're in the last days before the Lord comes back again. That's true, we are. But it also needs to be said that on the day of Pentecost, Peter stood up and declared that the outpouring of the Holy Spirit on the apostles and their witnessing to people in languages that the other people could understand was the accomplishment of the prophecy of Joel: in the last days, I will pour out my spirit on all people. So the last days are already there on the day of Pentecost. Jesus himself, when speaking to his disciples about the destruction of the temple, linked that destruction with his coming again. And when Jerusalem was destroyed by Rome in AD 70, Jesus, talking about that event, said, "When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of birth pains." So those passages lead me to conclude that the unsealing of the scroll begins a pattern that carries on right the way through the times that we're living in. As I've already said, the seedbed that John had was the Old Testament. Hence the reading in Zechariah and lots of other things that we've been back through to the Exodus and other places. John's intention was to explain how Jesus fulfills Old Testament prophecy in his life and in his work and in the church as it goes on throughout the ages. We shouldn't confuse John with Nostradamus in predicting the future. That wasn't his intention at all. Those first Christians, they were facing satanically empowered beast, the Roman Empire. They were being forced to acknowledge Caesar as Lord or risk life and livelihood. They also faced false apostles and prophets who were seeking to undermine the purity of the gospel. And since they were being forced to confront those issues, God gave them this heavenly perspective through these visions. They had to know that their struggles weren't in vain, that the victory was assured and they would be vindicated. Just before looking at the text itself, let's briefly look at the cycles of judgments. We're going to discover that the seven seal judgments, chapter 6, verse 1 to 8, verse 5, the seven trumpets, chapter 8, verse 6 through to 11, 19, and the seven bowl judgments of Revelation 16 are going to be repetitions, but with greater intensity as we go on, and not one thing that follows after another chronologically. When we did the series of Bible studies in Dig Deeper, if you remember, the home group, we sort of saw the broad spread of things, how God planned things through, and then how the fall came, and then little by little things improved, and then it fell again, and then Jesus came, and so on. That's the big picture, and that's, I think, what Revelation shows us. In fact, it's the opening of the seventh seal which brings in the trumpets, and we can imagine the trumpets as heralds about to proclaim an important message. I suppose you've seen the state opening of Parliament, where you've got the trumpeters who are there and who sound the trumpet before the Queen stands up and gives her speech. In the trumpets here in Revelation, we hear the kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of the Lord and his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. And then as we go on, we get to chapter 16, verse 17, it is done. That's the voice coming from the throne. Everything is finished. But we're only three quarters of the way through the book. We haven't got to the end, but it's chapter 16, verse 17, it's done. Remember that Jesus spoke of the times of the end when he answered the disciples' questions about the destruction of the temple. They were in absolute amazement about this beautiful building that they had, and Jesus said that not one stone would be left standing. And he linked the destruction of the temple with his second coming. We find it in Matthew chapter 24, in Mark 13, and in Luke 21. And just for the sake of brevity, I've taken the passage in Mark 13, and it gives us this. If you look at the seven seals, you have a white horseman who sets out to conquer, and Jesus talks about false Christs deceiving many. The red horse going out to war, Jesus speaks about wars and rumours of wars, international conflict and carnage, and Jesus speaks about international conflict. We talk about the black horse bringing famine, Jesus mentions famine. The pale horse brings death. We've got the fifth seal, which speaks of persecution, and Jesus speaks about persecution. The sixth seal, which speaks of earthquakes and cosmic upheaval, and Jesus speaks about earthquakes and cosmic upheaval. And then there's divine judgment, and Jesus speaks about divine judgment. So you see the parallel between what Jesus is saying and this picture form that we have here in Revelation. And I think people, we could all avoid lots of errors of interpretation if we took into account those parallels, because otherwise you've got to find how on earth certain things interact with what Jesus taught. We can't have them contradicting each other. So that's one way of preventing us from thinking that the seven seals, the trumpets, are successive waves of judgment. It doesn't fit with what Jesus taught. You remember I mentioned Jesus saying that these were like birth pains. Now, you've given birth to children, so you know what it's like. I don't, from personal experience, obviously. But Jesus states that these things must take place and the end is yet to come. Birth pains. If intense effort and pain characterize the delivery of a baby, the early contractions are followed by periods of relief. But towards the end, the periods of relief disappear as the contractions become more and more intense. And with the last contractions, you don't know which one's going to be the last until you actually give birth, and then all is revealed. Well, that's a little bit what Jesus is saying. You know, the intensity of these various things in successive waves. At the beginning, there are intervals in between, but as things approach the end, we don't know exactly when the end is going to come, but we know it is going to come. So we have this fact that the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls all describe some form of judgment. Revelation chapter 5, verses 1 to 14, gave us the opening scene in glory with people worshipping the Lamb. And then he opens the scroll and the judgment starts. But the opening of the scroll is linked to that vision that we have at the beginning. The same thing happens when we get to the trumpets, because in chapter 8 we discover that the trumpets are the reply to the prayers of the saints. So again, the trumpets are linked to something which is taking place in heaven. And there's always this link between what happens here and what happens there. And that too is important to see. I've already mentioned the fact that there are cycles, so I won't go back over that again now. So we come to this vision. As the vision of the heavenly throne unfolds, John's attention moves, as I said last week, from the glory of the one on the throne to the slain Lamb, who is alone worthy to open the seals. And now, as John watches, one of the living creatures with a voice like thunder invites him to come, and this is what he sees. As the first seal is opened, there are four horsemen. And that's why I read Zechariah chapter 6, verses 1 to 8, because that sends us back to that prophecy of Zechariah. Four coloured horses and their chariots, representing the four winds of heaven going out to the four corners of the earth. And as we've said already, the four symbolizes the four winds, the four corners. So in John's vision, the four horsemen go out to the ends of the earth to bring judgment on those who oppose God's rule and oppress his people. Not only do they bring vindication to God's people, but those first four judgments virtually mirror that passage that we looked at in Mark chapter 13. And the following three seals include the cry of the martyrs under the altar. The sixth heralds the end of the earth, and the seventh brings absolute silence to heaven. And each time a seal is opened, John hears a voice saying, "Come," and another horse comes out with its rider. The first one is a white horse. Now, some commentators think that this rider is none other than Jesus himself, and they link it to chapter 19, verse 11, where there is also a rider on a white horse, and there it's obvious that it is Jesus. But here I don't agree, and the reasons are these. In chapter 19, Christ is shown as going out to conquer unbelief through the power of his word. There is a double-edged sword coming out of his mouth. He is wearing many crowns. This rider comes out with a bow, and he is given a crown. Now, Jesus wears a crown because he is King of Kings. He's not given it by somebody else. And he's not carrying a bow. He's got the double-edged sword coming out of his mouth. He is the lamb who opens the seals. So he can't be the lamb and also the rider. There again, it doesn't fit. I suggest that he is someone sent by Jesus to carry out his conquest. The rider with the bow is a symbol of war. The white horse represents victory. If in chapter 19 the rider is called the faithful and true, this rider here is anything but faithful and true. He is bent on destruction, and we need to remember that as well. There's been some speculation about the relationship with the second one, but I'm not going to go into too many details about that. I think that this rider is in fact a false Christ, an imitation. Like we've seen that there's an imitation in the Trinity, a diabolical Trinity, as an imitation of the real Trinity. So we have someone here who is a false Christ, seeking to engage war against the true disciples of the Lord Jesus. In Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Jesus warns of false Christs and false prophets. And unfortunately, they've been legion throughout the ages. Then we come to the second rider, riding a fiery red horse. Red being the colour of blood, blood flowing in abundance. And there's a passage in the Old Testament in 2 Kings, chapter 3, where we read this. When they got up early in the morning, the sun was shining on the water. To the Moabites across the way, the water looked red, like blood. That's blood, they said. Those kings must have fought and slaughtered each other. Now to the plunder. And that's the type of image that this horse is trying to portray. Everywhere he goes, there is mass slaughter. Bloodthirsty rider taking peace away, creating bloodshed wherever he goes. People kill each other. The large sword is a symbol of the slaughter. The first rider brings death by invasion and conquest. This one provokes the same horror through widespread war. And wars have decimated the world's population for centuries. I can't go back all the way through history to the wars of Jewish times and Roman times, the Moorish invasion of Europe, the French Revolution, the English Civil War. There are loads and loads. But let's just limit ourselves to the 20th century. This week was the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And we know the atrocities and the number of people who were slaughtered there. There was the Turkish extermination of the Armenians in 1915, which killed millions of Armenians. Joseph Stalin killed millions of his own people between the 30s and the 50s. Pol Pot is reported to have slaughtered 1 million Cambodians in the killing fields in the 70s. And I haven't mentioned the two world wars and what's happened since. So there is mass slaughter, and that's the red horse. The third rider is seated on a black horse, and the pair of scales that he holds in his hands are used for measuring food. This symbolizes the aftermath of war, because very often when a war comes, things are destroyed and people starve. One follows on from the other. There's in John's day, a quart of wheat, that's about a litre of wheat, was the average food supply for a soldier for one day, but it also cost a day's wages. Barley was mixed with the wheat in order to bring down the cost, but the overall price tag would have been 12 times as much as it normally would have cost. It does say that the oil and the wine were not touched, and some have interpreted that as meaning that the wealthy could continue to live as usual. But in those days, oil and wine were common products that they used everywhere anyway. So it wasn't just a question of the rich being able to carry on as usual, and it was only the poor that were suffering. They weren't luxuries, and the Old Testament shows us that. It's probably wisest to deduce that the famine will be limited in its scope. Not only is God holy and will punish all human sin, he's also gracious and long-suffering and takes pity on his creation. And then we have the fourth rider, the pale horse, Chloros. You've heard of chloroform? Or it comes from a Greek word, chloros, meaning pale or sickly. The colour of a corpse. But that's the name of the rider, Death. And he's accompanied by Sheol or Hades, the place of the dead. And he receives the power to kill a quarter of the population by the sword, by famine, by the plague, and by wild beasts. Now, if you go back to Ezekiel chapter 14, we've had something of the same thing back there in Ezekiel, where the sovereign Lord warns of judgment against Jerusalem. And when Babylon invaded and burnt Jerusalem, the people were left to die simply because they had no means of survival. So they are terrible judgment, but they are limited to a quarter of the population of the earth. Remember that back in chapter 1, in the initial vision, John saw one like the Son of Man, and he is the one who holds the keys of death and hell. So the devil is limited in what he can do. These riders are limited in what they can do because the boundaries are set. They can't go any further than that. So what can we learn about these things? How can we take comfort, or what message can we take away from all of this? When the Lamb opens the scroll that has been sealed until the time of the end, we're given just a partial glimpse of how things are going to go until the Lord comes back again. These seals cover the period of time between, well, the time when John wrote it and when the Lord comes back again. And as we've seen already, there's going to be intensification. Things are going to get worse, a bit like the birth pains, which accelerate as the day of deliverance arrives. There are people today who think of climate change and what can we do to avoid climate change. I believe that what's going on today in different places in the world are part of God's judgment on an unbelieving and a rebellious world. We turn away from him. This country has turned away from him. Australia has turned away from him. Other places too have turned away from him. And we're reaping the consequences of what is going on. To the readers in those early days, at the end of the first century, John's vision would have brought comfort, because to them Rome seemed to be invincible. It was this massive great power that ordered everything as far as their lives were concerned. They were stopped from belonging to the trade guilds, they were stopped from eating, they were stopped from selling, they were stopped from this, that and the other. But if you go back beyond, Babylon thought itself to be invincible, Nineveh thought itself to be invincible, but they all fell. And Rome fell, and other civilizations have fallen, the Aztecs, the Mayas in South America. And people today who think, well, we've just voted for, or we've just come out of the European Union, and people like Nigel Farage have been claiming that we want to make Britain great again. But it's only the Lord that can make Britain great again. We've totally forgotten our Christian heritage. It was through the Lord that we were able to survive and go forward. Over the past 2,000 years, the world has been racked by chaos and disorder. There have been natural disasters, earthquakes, hurricanes, wars, genocide, diseases, Black Death, AIDS, SARS, Ebola, and now the coronavirus. And nobody knows where it's come from and how it's transmitted exactly. They will find an answer to it, I'm sure, but who's to say that there won't be another one afterwards? And all of these things are going on. There are so-called superbugs that resist antibiotics and so on. War continues to rage in Syria and Afghanistan, not to mention the unrest in Nigeria, Somalia, Kenya, Hong Kong, other places. We can ask ourselves the question, are we living in a world left to its own devices? Because everything seems to be totally chaotic. Or is God trying to tell us something? That's the way I look at it. God is trying to tell us something. We can't bury our heads in the sand and pretend that these things aren't going on, because they are going on. We see it on our television screens every day. And there are Christians who are suffering alongside non-Christians, but it's all part of what is described. What the world can't take away from us is our salvation and the fact that one day we'll be with the Lord in glory. But there are people who say, well, where is God? What's he doing? If there's a God, why isn't he intervening? He is, but not in the way that they expect. He's not an absent landlord. He's taking a serious interest in what is going on down here. And there is a little word in Greek, which is, I'll put it in the next slide. It's the little word edothe, which means it was given. God gives people the power, limited power, to do certain things. Things seem to be chaotic as far as we're concerned. We don't understand what's going on because it's beyond the realm of our capacity to intervene and do something about it. But it was given to them to do. These riders were sent out and they were told just a quarter of the population, no more. And then when we get later on to the trumpets, it'll be a third of the population, no more. And as the plagues in Egypt, Malcolm was talking about the plagues this morning, that the children of Israel were protected whilst the Egyptians were struck. And God intervened to protect his people and judge the others. And God is powerful enough to do that. So we must trust him. But everything starts and finishes with him. And I think that's something that we really need to hang on to. So what is happening today, as far as I'm concerned, is what happens when God shows his displeasure with what is going on in the world, a world that has turned its back on him. Obviously, it's not a popular point of view. And there are people who are going to resist and people saying they're going to say that they don't agree. But it doesn't mean that God isn't in charge. He is in charge. In the light of what we've just seen, I can predict the reaction of some people who say, well, you see, Jesus said there'd be wars and rumours of wars before his return. And that's true. There are wars, there are rumours of wars. But Jesus also said, the end is still to come. It's a bit like the birth pains. We don't know exactly when it's going to come. For the moment, his anger is restrained. He hasn't finished with us yet. His time of mercy is still here, and we must seize the opportunities that we have to witness to others while we have time. But the day is coming when he will say, stop, that's it. And he will come again, and there will be judgment. Final judgment. Although we may look forward to that day because we will be with him. You have loved ones, I have loved ones, and we long for them to put their trust in the Lord before it's too late. And that's what I think part of what this message is all about.